Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, I speak with J.C. Hallman to talk about his book, Say Anarcha, published by Henry Holt in June 2023. We recorded this interview via Zoom on July 7th, 2023. J.C., welcome to Bio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, who is Anarcha?
Anarcha is the most consequential of approximately 10 experimental subjects of Dr. J. Marion Sims, who in 1846 set out to cure fistula. And his claimed success on the young woman known as Anarcha is sort of the fulcrum central focus of his career, the thing that ultimately led to his being known as the father of modern gynecology. So Anarcha and the other women who were experimented on are, in a sense, the mothers of gynecology and stand on a pedestal of their own at the center of the creation story of modern women's health.
J. Marion Sims is a character in this dual biography. Why did you choose to write it from two different points of view? In other words, one chapter is about Anarcha and another chapter is about J. Marion Sims, and so goes the book. So why did you choose this format?
I thought that the dual nature of the story captured something about the dual nature of this particular period in history, you know, in a lot of different ways, you know, just in terms of race, in terms of the North and the South, in terms of wealth. Inequalities that there were a lot of ways in which the 19th century, particularly the middle 50 years of the 19th century, were bifurcated. And I thought of those two different stories as embodying that separation.
We know about J. Marion Sims, or many of us do, I think, right? Do most people know about J? I think J. Marion Sims is a very modern character, right? He came to consciousness, like modern consciousness, what, in 2007, correct?
He had been a sort of hero of modern medicine, particularly early in the 20th century. It kind of faded out over time. And then a reevaluation of his legacy really began in the late 60s. And there were a couple of books, a couple of dissertations turned books that appeared from scholars. And for a long time, Sims sort of remained, kind of in the scholarly world as a figure of consideration. But then in 2007, with Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid in particular, she used him as this kind of fulcrum figure to tell a very broad story about the abuse of African Americans in the medical industry. And it's interesting because that's basically, you know, the role that Sims had played. You know, even though he was a small part of her book and he was a small part of medical history, he was this sort of fulcrum figure. And so for a while, you know, I would say it wasn't really until 2017 when a bunch of people who were fired up by Harriet Washington's book and by a couple of other books as well, really kicked it into high gear in terms of protesting, in particular, Sims' Central Park Monument in New York City. You know, when I started working on Sims way back in 2015, he was pretty obscure. Not too many people I encountered knew about him. But then the White Nationalist March happened in Charlottesville. Protesters who had been fighting against the Sims Monument in New York staged yet another protest, and this time it went viral. And then after that, Sims was pretty broadly known, and then that profile was raised even further during the pandemic, when African American vaccine hesitancy, total understandable vaccine hesitancy as a result of the abuse of African Americans over time by the medical world, also raised his profile, you know, that he suddenly was synonymous with the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, where before he had been a somewhat obscure figure.
Well, you've referred to him as a medical predator. Who are the defenders of Sims today?
You know, I mean, there are people who still hang on to the claims about Sims' career. When he died, there was this whole list of things that they thought he was going to be remembered for. You know, the first cure of fistula was one, the Sims speculum was one, even his so-called cure for infant lockjaw at the time of his death was thought to have been an important advance. His vaginismus surgery was still being practiced. Incision of the cervical canal was still happening in some quarters. But all of that stuff fell by the wayside. And you know, more recently, like the claims that he was the first to employ silver suture material was a common one floating around, and other claims like that. And those claims had become really deeply embedded in the literature. So you could easily find many claims about Sims in peer-reviewed journals, in scholarly articles, in scholarly books. And, you know, but what I found pretty early on when I started looking at him was that he hadn't been subjected to a truly forensic deep dive of his entire career. And that's what I did. And what I found was that virtually everything, really, I'm hard pressed to come up with anything that didn't just fall to that deep dive examination, that everything he did was either stolen from someone else or has been debunked by the profession since his death. So there's really nothing left, you know, but there are a lot of sources out there that will tell you that he did a number of important things. And there are people who have been living with that legacy and that belief in that ultimately fraudulent legacy for a long time. And it's going to take time to undo that. But they are out there. I think that the Sims apologists have tended to go into hiding, you know, at the current moment. You know, and there's a concern that the backlash against Sims is based on a projection of modern values into the past. And that's just simply false. In many other people's work and in my work too, you know, the criticisms of Sims come from his contemporaries. They come from former presidents of the AMA. You know, Sims was president of the AMA himself in 1876. Even before that, he had critics who were, you know, in the AMA, and his absolute worst critics, the ones who said the worst things about him, were the doctors who knew him best. They were his assistants. The doctors who sat beside him as he worked went on to become his greatest critics. So there's nothing I say about in the Sims half of, say, Anarcha. You know, there's nothing I say that doesn't ultimately come from someone who knew him, who was watching him work. And I think that that's an important point to make in light of those who today would defend Sims' career on the argument that what we're doing is projecting modern values into the past. That's just not what's happening.
You title your book, Say Anarcha. What brought you to this title?
Well, you know, obviously it was, you know, it was Say Her Name and then Anarcha. You know, I think that when I first started researching the book, the first thing I did, you know, is when I was looking at all the sources and I just realized, well, okay, there'd been all this work on Sims, but there hadn't been a concerted effort to find Anarcha. And so, you know, I just went to Alabama. I just got up and went very speculatively, very, you know, not knowing what I would find. And, you know, based on the few hints that were available, I was able to find the first evidence of Anarcha's life that didn't come from Sims himself. You know, for almost 200 years, he was the only source. Everyone who ever wrote about Sims or Anarcha was trusting him in some way and choosing to not trust him in other ways. And I just wondered if it was possible to find her. And that turned out to be the case. And then almost immediately, I then pivoted and I was sort of planning on writing a book right from the get-go, but I immediately pivoted to write an article for Harper's Magazine specifically about the Sims Monument in New York. You know, and I went to one of these protests at the sites of his Central Park Monument. And the women's groups, the African-American groups that gathered, you know, were marching up Fifth Avenue, chanting, "Say her name, Anarcha, say her name, Lucy, say her name, Betsy." And, you know, that "Say Her Name, Anarcha" really stuck with me. And, you know, and "Say Anarcha" came from that.
It's a beautifully written book. And in the end, you created a list of maybe how many, 500 enslaved people, that these are the testimonies that you leaned on to tell her story. Was it 500 or so?
Yeah, approximately, yeah. And it was, in telling Anarka's story, you know, I first did a massive search for her all over the country in archives and probate offices and private manuscript collections. And I was able to piece together her life story, you know, where she'd gone, the fact that she'd not actually been cured, that the so-called first cure of the father of gynecologists was not actually cured, discovering events that she was associated with, and then ultimately following her story all the way to her gravesite in a remote Virginia forest. But that was like a scaffold of facts, and it was data, right? And what was clear, both for the Sims part of the story and the Anarka part of the story, was that the telling of the story needed to feel lived. It needed to have scenes and characters. And, you know, I didn't want to only be, to write something that was only in conversation with other things that had been written about this. You know, I wanted something that really got at the complexities of the stories and the complexities of the questions that it raised by putting the reader into that situation, right? Into scenes and moments. And so the way to do that with the scaffold of facts about Anarka's life was to augment that scaffold with additional facts. You know, and those additional facts were coming from the Works Progress Administration Slave Narrative Project that saw thousands or hundreds of interviews go across the country to interview thousands of formerly enslaved peoples in the late 1930s. And that produced about 55 books worth of material. I read them all, and I borrowed from those sources to give Anarka's life a sense of presence and milieu and atmosphere that just that scaffold of facts wasn't going to have. So I created a kind of collage of facts that presented a version of Anarka's story that I thought was an improvement on the utterly fictional version of her story that Sims gave us, and which had stood as unquestioned history for 200 years. The list you're talking about at the front of the book was the way of acknowledging all of those narratives, 500 people whose accounts of their time enslaved helped me to create this composite figure of Anarka. And we thought a lot about this. You know, my name's not on the cover of the book. There's no acknowledgement page. There's no dedication in the book. That this big block of 500 names is what there is by way of acknowledging, you know, where the story came from and to whom it is indebted.
So to what extent did you travel in Anarka's footsteps? She was a property of the Westcott Plantation, but she also traveled to New York, and she was also the property of several other enslavers. And at times, you note that she lived in the woods. Tell me about how you came across this type of information.
Sometimes it was making inferences based on the sources that I found. So saying that Anarka worked as a nurse prior to the Alabama fistula experiments that Sims performed on her and approximately 9 other young women, and that she worked as a nurse during those experiments, and then that she acted as a nurse and midwife for the remainder of her life. That all comes from sources, either you know, sort of direct statements that she's working as a nurse, or inferences based on stray references in bits of correspondence. Like, you know, so for example, you know, I do have her from the period after she acquires her fistula, which is the condition that Sims is going to claim to try to cure on her.
For listeners who don't know what fistula is, can you just briefly tell us what that is?
Sure. A fistula is technically speaking just an abnormal point of communication between two hollow organs in the body, or two hollow spaces in the body. In the case of obstetric fistula, which is a fistula that results from prolonged obstructed labor, that usually is a point of communication between the bladder and the vagina. and it results in a leak of urine from the vagina. It can also be urethral and it can also be rectal, but obstetric fistula is really the condition in question. And, you know, what happens, you know, so the afterword of the book looks at the modern legacy of fistula and in Africa, where this is an ongoing condition. And what you often see there is women who have this condition are ostracized. They're forced to live away from their families. They're divorced. They're separated. They're believed to be cursed. Some of, you know, what I found when I traveled to Nigeria, Uganda, and Ethiopia to bear witness to those efforts in 2018, some of those I incorporated into an Anarcha's story. And so for that period, after she acquires her fistula and before she is taken in to be experimented upon, I have her living out in the woods, being sent there because her condition would make her rank and unpleasant to be around. And so she lives there for a time. That's very much in keeping with what is seen very frequently in Africa today and across the developing world. And also, you know, that enslaved people would sometimes escape and go live in the woods. And that specific details from Anarcha's story are in fact coming from specific persons whose accounts that I'd absorbed. And it seemed just a very likely outcome for Anarcha's story rather than something that could be directly documented. That's that combination. I'm wavering between direct evidence for things, various degrees of circumstantial evidence, and then sometimes speculation, sometimes guesswork, sometimes informed inference. And all of that working together adds up to Anarcha's story, or this version of Anarcha's story.
So this term speculative biography comes up then about somebody who history doesn't really have a hold of, archivally speaking. And so you've created this anarchaarchive.com. So listeners can go to the website anarchaarchive.com to verify the facts in your book. This speculative biography has roots. It becomes less speculative, I guess. What made you organize this archive, a public website or a public domain?
There were 5,000 citations. When we were contemplating putting just a portion of them in the book, we pulled out a section and it was going to fill 85 pages, 85 additional pages of the book. And that was 7% of the sources that I had. So when you do choose to do that, you know, I assume this happens with a lot of other books. Ultimately, you can't include everything, right? So you have to pick and choose. And so then it looks like ultimately you're putting things into your book that are not cited. And so I wanted to create the archive so that people would have a place to go, not only to see a traditional citation, but to actually see an image of what it was I was looking at, because I screenshot everything. And you can just look and see at my source in real time. When I'm saying that Anarcha was doing this, it's because I was looking at this source. And when I am engaging in something that's more speculative in the archive, I have an essay that explains why I think this is the most likely probability for this portion of Anarcha's life, though I will acknowledge that other possibilities may also have been the reality of her life. So to that extent, the book is acknowledging itself to be a thought experiment. And I would say that a lot of biography and a lot of history tends to do this without acknowledging the fact that it's doing that. I was shedding new light on a narrative that I believed was sort of filled with calcified errors. The accepted history. There were all of these mistakes. There were all of these errors. So I was telling a very different story. And when you do that, I think you have to make sure that those who want to scrutinize you have that ability to do so in a way that's easy. And, you know, I mean, and probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with the arcane codes that get used to condense sources down to the smallest amount of material so that it fills up as little space in a book as possible, and how difficult it is to decipher that. And it makes that kind of engagement with the sources really difficult. And I think that's sad because it makes the research that historians and biographers do look so tedious and awful. And in fact, that kind of searching is, it's like a treasure hunt. It's incredibly exciting. And so I wanted to create the archive in a way that would let other people feel some of the excitement that I felt when I was looking at the original sources. And last, I think that particularly for those more speculative choices, that I wanted to invite the reader to have the opportunity to scrutinize those choices. Because I think if you are going to bring a robust creative process to bear on a body of fact, then you need to acknowledge it and you need to discuss it. And it's my belief that if the reader feels in on it, that they will go with you. They will understand that this is a thought experiment, and so it is a creative process that still will fall under the umbrella of nonfiction. So that's why I created the archive.
How did you choose which photocopies of these signatures in these archival documents? How did you choose which ones to put into the text?
I think in the book itself, there's about 80 images of some of those archival materials. I guess I thought that there were moments when I wanted the reader to be, I wanted them to be occurring at a regular pace, because I wanted the reader to simultaneously get caught up in a story, something that felt like a novel as you're reading it, but which you had these occasional reminders was all rooted in fact. And that sometimes it would speak to Anarka's name, seeing her name in somebody's handwriting is really chilling. And I wanted that. But sometimes I wanted it to be some relatively obscure fact. You know, like if I say that the Westcott plantation had a sorrel mare on the plantation, I wanted you to see sorrel mare, you know, in that old handwriting, so that you know that I'm really acting more as a kind of curator than I am as a writer, in the sense that I'm going out there and I'm selecting facts and I'm organizing them. I just wanted there to be that perpetual reminder that the story was rooted in fact.
It became obvious to me that you take pictorial evidence of your research, and I wondered what your writing process was like. So you go to an archive, let's say, and you spend the day there photographing all of this evidence. Then what do you do with that information? Do you go home and write, or are you writing simultaneously, or do you collect all the information and then begin your writing process?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think with this book, it was a little different for me because, you know, I'm a white man writing about African-American history, and I'm writing about women's health. So you really couldn't imagine a situation where one is stepping further outside of their own lived experience. I went through a long, long period of just gathering and absorbing that reading of the slave narratives. You know, this 55 books worth of material, that took a year. It was one of the most profound reading experiences of my life. And, you know, usually, you know, what I do with sources, I'll create big, long charts, big, long timelines. And I have, you know, I don't know, 12 or 15 timelines. Some of them are like 13 feet long, and they're filled with little tiny scrawl, like serial killer writing, you know. I mean, and I would have those and I would carry them around with me wherever I would go and just sort of keep them available. But then I outgrew those. What I then had to do was turn my notes into almost like magazine style booklets for individual years of Sim's life and Anarka's life. And I had these sort of stapled together so that they open like magazines. And I did that with the slave narrative materials as well. And so when I was actually writing, I was usually writing from those books. You know, I would be crossing things out and taking notes. And I still have all of those and the charts as well. It's, you know, I've always worked in that way, you know, with this extensive research and these charts, but it went much further for that. You know, and I guess probably the anarchaarchive.com is the online version, you know, of all of that work. You know, I mean, essentially what's on there is like the fact check of the book. It's important to point out that before I wrote the book, I wrote three different magazine articles, all of which were heavily fact-checked. Books don't get fact-checked. You know, there might be a peer review, but you might not get a peer review from someone who actually knows your subject.
How did you take care of your mind and your person while you were writing this book?
The first thing I did was I avoided the impulse to binge. I have always been a methodical writer, so I write a page a day, you know, and that can mean, 200 words, 250 words a day, rarely more than that. And sometimes I will stop myself if I turn a page. My goal every day is to just turn the page, to get to the next page. And sometimes I'll get to the next page and I'll have a lot of momentum, and I will intentionally stop myself because I know what comes next. And knowing that, having that momentum, that's gold as a writer, right? If you just keep going to where you don't know what comes next and you sit down the next day, you're still not going to know what's going to come next. And that's going to create obstacles for yourself. So pacing, I think was really just in the writing itself. And then also, I've long thought that taking care of your body is part of the work. I was doing a lot of yoga while I was writing the book. I also swim, and I just try to keep fit. It's not always easy, and it's not always easy to convince yourself that going for a swim is part of the writing, but it is. And even though I think that I work very slowly, I think people tend to look at my career. This is my seventh book, big book. It's exhaustively researched, and people sort of seem to think I'm very productive, and it doesn't feel that way to me. I mean, the shorthand is just to say that you're thinking more like a tortoise than a hare, but then the tortoise needs to exercise as well. So,
100%. I agree. Yeah. Well, JC, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was my conversation with JC Hallman talking about his book, Say Anarcha, published by Henry Holt in June 2023. We recorded this interview via Zoom on July 7th, 2023. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. Alani Hodge created our theme music. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.